Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Hey everybody, it's Eric Beiler. I'm here with Michael Charney. And
hello.
Happy 4th of July to you. Happy 4th of July, Michael.
Happy 4th of July to you. Welcome,
so,
everybody.
So I wanted to give you a chance, since you are actually, as it turns out, the last of our five radio shows, to have a chance to respond to what I found to be a surprising decision by the United States Supreme Court that the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. As a conservative, albeit a conservative who is sometimes under fire for being not conservative enough, Michael Charney, what did you make of that ruling?
I was surprised by the ruling. Chief Justice Roberts definitely went Solomon, right? He definitely split the baby, and I have mixed feelings about it. I still fundamentally think that it doesn't feel like a tax to me. It feels like a penalty, and I think, despite what the right-wing rhetoric is saying, I think the percentage of people who are actually going to be affected by this tax, so-called tax, is well under 2%, I think, are the estimates. And so it's hard to imagine it as a tax. And, of course, the administration sold it as not being a tax and continues, actually, to argue that it's kind of not really a tax. We shouldn't be thinking of it that way. And I understand why. Tax is it's a red-letter word. Right? It probably never would have gotten as far as it got if it had been pushed as a tax in the first place. Nevertheless, I can see the rationale of calling it that. I can't say I'm 100% comfortable with the decision. That's a little bit different, Eric, than whether or not I think the Affordable Care Act is a good thing. Mm-hmm. If you separate out the individual mandate, I do think that it is it's historic, and it moves the conversation in the right directions. And even in the past week or so, Governor Romney has, in his own attempt to be Solomon-like, has argued against the Affordable Care Act while supporting certain provisions of it. And I have a feeling that regardless of what happens, there's going to be a tremendous amount of go forward and hashing out and change that will come to it. As you know, I don't. In some ways, I think it goes too far. In some ways, I don't think it goes far enough. And my own personal position has always been that if we were to look at the insurance industry as a public utility, and in much the ways that years ago public utilities were semi-regulated industries with defined profit margins, that would be a far better starting place for the kinds of decisions that need to be made in terms of not dismantling an entire industry, but at the same time providing reasonable health care for the many millions who need it. So I'm neither happy nor sad about the decision. I'm tentatively hopeful that it will lead in more productive directions, but it's undeniably better to have a starting place than not. And if that wasn't Solomon enough of an answer for you.
Well, thank you for that. And maybe before the show is over, I can ask you also, I was curious about your feelings about certain states led by Bobby Jindal of Louisiana saying that they're given the option by the Supreme Court, they're not going to expand Medicaid. And so it would leave many, many millions of people uninsured who could be insured if the states would accept the federal money. I wanted to give you a chance, though, to introduce our guest, Allison Smith. I'm really excited to talk to her. So I'll hand it over to you, Michael.
Okay, so let me, you know, as regular listeners of the show, this is our fifth show, right? So at most, I guess anybody could be a semi-regular listener, but know that I usually try to introduce a little bit of the subject matter up front. So let me talk a little bit about our subject tonight, and actually next week as well, is poverty. And to me, it's kind of a logical extension of the discussions around Obamacare, because so many, or the Affordable Care Act, I have to be careful which phrase I use, so many of the people who will be positively impacted are, in fact, people who are near or on or just below the poverty line, and who for various reasons have fallen into gaps in between regular health care and Medicaid, for example, and of course, you know, small children and students who in this economy aren't able to get jobs. A lot of these people fall under that rubric. So I wanted to sort of extend the topic a little bit and talk about poverty in general. So this week we're going to be talking sort of at a micro level. Allison Smith, who I'll bring on in a moment, has had very real hands-on experience with poverty, probably in ways that most of us have never experienced. And then next week we have a guest on who's going to talk more about the macro level sort of economic impacts and what it takes for a country as rich as ours to really have as many poor people as we do. Actually, Eric, I wanted to throw a question at you, which I did not tell you I was going to ask you, because a little bit of what I want to talk about is sort of the narratives around poverty for a couple of minutes. So what does it mean to you, you know, when you hear about poverty in the United States? What does it mean? What do you think of?
You know, I often go back to where I feel ashamed and guilty when I'm asked questions like this. I remember growing up in Virginia, there was a family who lived around the corner, and they had several children, maybe three, four, and I remember that the girl that was my age once came to our door to try to sell us donuts out of a Krispy Kreme thing, and I remember thinking that was kind of sad and desperate. I later learned that the reason they were in such dire straits was that the youngest boy had been born with a backwards heart, and he'd had to have a surgery, of course, to get it facing the right way, and he had this tremendously gruesome scar. And the kids were always just kind of, you know, struggling to, you know, pinch two pennies together, you know, they didn't have very nice clothes, and they didn't seem to be well washed, and I just remember, I don't know how it comes to be, but I just remember having negative feelings about them, not necessarily compassion, but you know, just like I don't want to associate with them or something like that. Now I was very young, less than 10, but it's just funny how these things somehow filter down through society, that people who are struggling, somehow it's their fault, and therefore I don't have to deal with it, or I don't have to think of myself as in danger of being in the same situation. I mean, now that I think back on it, I mean, the reason why they're in trouble was they probably didn't have health insurance to pay for their son to survive. And
right.
So they were paying for it for the rest of their lives. And I sure hope they're okay today. And, you know, I feel bad that I, you know, I didn't buy the donut and I, you know, whatever. I just, you know, I just wasn't that nice to the girl that was my age. And it's something that still kind of strikes me. So when you asked me that question impromptu without warning, that's what popped in my head. And I think it is a really powerful thing that super narratives, of course, they're paid for by the 1%, because until very recently, the only people who could afford to buy a news network or make a movie or you know, broadcast on the radio, you know, like we're doing for free, but it wasn't long ago that only the most, you know, the luckiest people could do that. Those narratives do tend to speak about people who are less fortunate in a way that essentially blames them, uses tropes like laziness, or uses divisive rhetoric that often is racially tinged to make us feel angry or blameful toward those people. So I try to have an awareness that it did kind of work its dark magic on me as a child. I think I learned better later in life. But the truth is, that's about as close as I really, really came to poverty, other than being a starving artist, you know, by choice. You know, so I'm no expert on it. I'm more of an expert on the media narratives, to be honest.
Yeah, we'll actually talk about that a little bit. When is it choice? But you've illuminated what is probably the strongest narrative in our country, and it probably ties back to the whole Puritan work ethic thing that somehow if you work hard, then you won't be poor. If you work hard and really, you know, the whole nose to the grindstone thing, you won't be poor. And we know that's not true. I mean, Jessica English, who does the Sunday Night Show on this network, has been very, very frank about her situation, and she works incredibly hard and yet struggles in many ways. But that's just one of the narratives. But let me throw out a few things. The narratives, and you know how I feel about how we always need a story, right? We need reasons. We need a sort of a there, but for the grace of God, go I. Mm-hmm. And these narratives all have a political purpose. So just a few that I jotted down. One of them is, and I love this one. This one, I think I originally heard it on a Rush Limbaugh program a number of years ago, where he said, "We have the richest poor people in the world."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, so what does that mean? And, you know, of course, he then brings up the tropes that trigger lots of racial ideas, right? He used some very obvious stereotypes for that. And that one just always struck me as odd. You know, but it's probably true in a very bizarre way. I mean, you know, World Bank defines poverty worldwide as making less than a dollar and a quarter a day, which is just a ridiculous number. And they, according to them, at that measure, roughly 22% of the world lives below what they deem the poverty line. But for any of us here, $1.25 a day is just absurd. I mean, obviously, poverty is a much higher threshold here. Here, in fact, for those who don't know, it's just over $23,000 a year for a family of four. And what I learned today, I did not realize, it's not linear. So apparently it's $11,000 if you're roughly $11,000 a year if you live by yourself, and then they add sort of $3,800 for each additional person in your household. And these numbers just they boggle the mind. Like, where do you come up with that? That if you have a child, and you have an extra $4,000, you're not poor anymore. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Another one is that, and you pointed it out, poverty is a problem of personal accountability. Poverty is blue. It's blue. It's a blue state urban problem, which is it turns out is also not true. And a lot of it has to do with how you look at these statistics. So I'll give you the following statistic, Eric. You tell me what you think. Let's see what we had here. The poverty rate for whites in this country is 9.9%. The poverty rate for African Americans is 27.4%. What does that tell you? Just off the top of your head. It's not a quiz. And for those listening, Eric and I didn't plan this. So
I thought of the New Deal first, and then I thought of slavery. So I thought about how, in order to get the New Deal passed, provisions needed to be included to exclude African Americans from opportunities to get loans to buy homes, for instance, and how home ownership was such an important bedrock for people to work their way out of poverty during the 20th century and during that period of economic growth that followed the Great Depression. And then, of course, I thought of slavery before, and immediately thought of how, other minorities in this country who came here as immigrants do face a level of institutionalized racism, but they also have that extra that extra momentum that you get when you come here following a dream, as opposed to come here in chains. So those are the two things that came to my mind. Oh, and the third thing is that there's a heck of a lot more white people in the United States than black people. So if you're going to say, well, screw them all because they're black, it's just it's just idiotic, because I don't know what the numbers are, but 9% of all the white people and 33% of all the black people, you still have a lot more white people in poverty.
Very good point, and I was going to say the next thing. Now listen to the same fact couched in a different statistic. There are 24 million white people living in poverty, 10 million African Americans.
Well, there you go.
Right. That's a story that's the side of a narrative that doesn't get told and doesn't necessarily bring up the same kind of thoughts or stereotypes or intonations that you just brought up. I would, my own feeling growing up, and I totally bought into the narrative that poverty was sort of an urban minority issue, much more so. But in fact, more than half of the people in this country living below the poverty line are white. And not surprisingly, I shouldn't say not surprisingly, there's another narrative that I'm playing into. With the exception of Florida, every single southern state is in the worst tier of poverty. Mm-hmm. And that just isn't the narrative that we're led to believe. We're led to believe it's sort of a big state, big city, urban problem, and it's not. It's a problem for everyone. So tonight we're going to talk with someone, Allison Smith, who has spent her admittedly still young career. She's been doing this for about 6 years now, working with the poor, and she's seen quite a bit. She worked in 2006. She went to Kenya, and again in 2008. First, she worked in Nairobi at the Mama Fatuma, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly, the Mama Fatuma Goodwill Children's Home. Later, she worked in Mombasa at the Foundation for Sustainable Development. In both cases, an emphasis of her work was children, women's issues, and sustainable community development. I met her after she had come back. I'm not sure if it was her first or second trip to Kenya originally, but when she came back the second time, she started working with the poor in the States, and she has worked on the Young Women's Project in D.C., and she'll tell us some interesting things about D.C. poverty levels. She's currently with the Bridge of Northeast Florida in Jacksonville. It's where she currently lives, and here to tell us her story. But just before I bring her on, I want to let everybody know that you're listening to The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, and we invite you to call in and participate. Our call-in number is area code 646-929-2495, and if you are interested in joining the conversation, just press 1, and we will know that you're looking to participate with us, to talk to us, to chat a bit. We will be able to identify you by area code, so when we call on your area code, you can tell us your name and where you're calling from. But again, 646-929-2495, and now I will happily welcome Allison Smith. Allison, welcome to The Middle Ground.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Eric. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing well, as you can tell. We just chatted up.
First, before we get started, is my volume okay?
I'm doing fine. I hear you fine. Eric, all good? No, Eric put himself on mute here, so he would let us know if there was a problem there. So Allison, just as a little bit by way of introduction, if you could expand on some of the work you've done. I gave you a brief introduction that doesn't at all do justice to, frankly, incredible work that I can't imagine. How you've lived I've seen the pictures, but how you've lived and what you've done for people. So maybe just kind of fill us in a little bit, and then we'll dig down a little bit on some of your experiences.
Sure. Well, first of all, I did grow up in suburban New Jersey, pretty blindsided to the idea of poverty, homelessness, et cetera. And I went away to college at American University in Washington, D.C., and American has this really great program called the Freshman Service Experience, where rather than doing an orientation week on campus, you actually go and work in nonprofits throughout the city and do volunteer work. So I was placed at an organization called Mary House in Northeast Washington, D.C., that housed families, mostly refugees who were homeless, and did transitional housing, after-school programs, educational activities. And they just had tremendous success taking very specific families. They didn't just deal with just men or just women. families became too busy and found themselves in poverty, and they would work with them to get them on their feet. I continued to work there for about 2 years, just volunteering with the kids there. And then a couple years later, decided to go abroad to Kenya for my study abroad experience. And, you know, looking at poverty from D.C. to Nairobi, Kenya, there are staunch differences. However, upon return to D.C., you start to say, some of these things aren't really that dissimilar. You still have people hanging out in the city parks because they have nowhere else to go. You know, here it's maybe a little bit more structured. We have soup kitchens. We have shelters. We have sort of the safety net system that developing countries don't have. But it does look pretty similar. I decided after college to move back to Kenya for a year.
So that's I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt. That's very interesting because I think that would totally go against the narrative, right? We have another narrative that we have about poverty, particularly international poverty, is that we're sort of, you know, the paternalistic father figure of helping everybody else who's much worse off than we are. And it sounds like you're saying that's not necessarily the case in a lot of situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the reasons why we have that narrative in this country is because poverty abroad, particularly Africa, is sort of glamorized. Simisa Moyo, she's one of the she's an economist and an author, and she wrote Dead Aid, and she has she's actually African, and she has a lot of sort of, I guess you could say, radical views on aid. But she argued that the worst problem that Africa has is bad PR. That, you know, you have all these celebrities who are working on poverty issues and have the TV ads of the starving children, but you don't see the real Africa. You don't see the countries and what they're doing to thrive. We just see the kids with flies in their eyes and their ribs, you know, popping out of their bodies. And that's not necessarily a fair narrative, a fair portrayal of countries like Kenya. There are plenty of communities that thrive. There are plenty of Kenyans who live in apartments nicer than I do right now. And they're not necessarily the rich elite either. So I would say that narrative certainly is part of how we view poverty here. It's not glamorous here. We don't talk about it in a way that, you know, we don't have impoverished kids get from New York City on TV appealing for you know, the dollar a day to help feed them. So you're absolutely right.
That's a really interesting point. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. I mean, there's Oprah Winfrey, there's Angelina Jolie, there's, you know, Madonna and her,
yeah,
personally, I find, obnoxious adoptions. But you're right. We are. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we've sort of made movie stars out of poor African children somehow, and yet we ignore the same stories here?
I think part of it is our own hubris. We want to believe that as Americans, we are number one and we're the greatest country and we can go out and make everybody else better. For us, it's a lot easier, I think, to say, oh, well, poverty, HIV, malaria, those are all African problems and those are all things that we don't have to face here and we can just send our money or, you know, go volunteer for 3 months and do our part. But really looking at it, you know, in the context of what's going on in our country, we have just as high HIV rates in some cities when you think of the per capita statistics. Like you said, America, you know, well, as Rush Limbaugh said, America has the richest poor people in the world, but what does that actually translate into? It just seems un-American to be poor, right?
Well, yeah, I don't know. I might push back on that a little. I mean, there are a lot of definitions of what it means to be American, but you know, we've had this war on poverty, and, you know, again, people who've listened to the show before know how much I sort of deplore the war on appellation, but the war on poverty started in, you know, theoretically 1964. I actually found Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union addresses when he first introduced the legislation that came to be known as the War on Poverty. And at that time, the poverty rate in the U.S. was 19.1%. Today, it's 15.1%, but in fact, it's been lower. And back in 2009, it was 14-something percent. It sort of argues that there is, you know, kind of wherever you go in the world, there is a stratification that implies some level of poverty everywhere. Is it even possible? I mean, in your mind, what would be, you know, is it? I guess I'm going to ask an abrasive question. Is it okay for there to be some poor people?
Absolutely. I think it would be unrealistic to think that you could eradicate poverty from every single crevice of the world. I think in some ways it's an inevitability. People will have less money than other people. Whether or not it's okay for people to be poor, I think that's kind of loaded, right? The ideal is that everybody is to survive, or at least have to keep the basic needs met, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, all right. So let's go back to the your experiences in Africa again. There's always the there's a lot of debate about spending money on aid, right? I would argue that given a limited amount of money in foreign aid, and you know, people can argue about whether that we should be spending more or we should be spending less. But no matter whether that pie is bigger than it is now, it's still going to be some finite number of money that is going to be spent. There's a strong argument that says that money should be spent in places that support our national interests in some ways. And maybe our national interest includes feeling good about ourselves, so to help people that we perceive as being worse off than we are. But is that a reasonable place? How are these places a reasonable place to spend money? How were these places that you work for funded? Was it American aid to some degree?
Yes. When I worked in Mombasa, Solidarity with Women in Distress was sort of the premier organization for dealing with sex workers and victims of human trafficking on the coast, and they did receive U.S. aid grants. When I worked in Nairobi at Mama Fatima's, which was a much smaller organization, it was just, you know, your local slums orphanage, I guess you could call it. They received some foreign grants. I know that they did have an ambassador's grant from one of the local ambassadors, but it wasn't American. They were mostly smaller grants, mostly funded from Kenyan corporations or Kenyan companies. So it varied for sure. I will say, most Americans, going back to your point on the piece of the pie, most Americans believe that foreign aid makes up 25% of our budget, when in reality, it's only 1%. So the amount of money that we spend on foreign aid is a very small sliver compared to, I think, 13% is spent domestically on our safety net programs, which includes cash assistance, in-kind assistance like food stamps, our free lunch program, low-income child care, et cetera. So there is much more money being spent at home in terms of assistance to those in need.
Interesting. I actually knew that it was a low number, but I did not realize that that there had been some sort of narrative built that people thought it was a tremendous number. I mean, it literally is a penny on the dollar. But a chunk of that, I wouldn't even know how to look up how that is broken down. But that's certainly not all for poverty related aid. I mean, we pay, for example, a certain amount of money, but we pay aid to Pakistan, and you know, that basically is for a hall pass, so that we get a chance to meddle if we want to, or keep an eye on our own interests.
Absolutely. A lot of the foreign aid programming also is either politically motivated, or, and I guess this is also politically motivated, but it's national security interest. So if we're doing development work in Afghanistan, if we're doing development work in Pakistan, and anywhere in the Middle East, it serves our national security interests to make those countries more productive. rather than giving them, keeping them, leaving them without the development and without democracy, as we'll say, leaves them open to harboring terrorists, I suppose. So that's one argument for foreign aid as well.
So are we actually, you know, staying with the international, and we'll come to the states in a minute, but are we actually doing any good? I mean, this seems to be a never, you know, as we talked, it's kind of a never-ending problem. And, you know, are we giving fish, or are we teaching them to fish? I mean, where what kind of impact have you actually seen?
Absolutely. I think, you know, bigger picture-wise, it depends on who you talk to. Some people will say, you know, foreign aid is absolutely necessary. I know Bill and Melinda Gates are doing a big push. Recently, I've seen them both in the news, you know, talking about how they really, their programs are working and not to cut foreign aid in addition to what they give worldwide. But then there are other experts in the field who say that the aid system is broken, that it's not effective, that it creates a culture of dependency on most developing countries. And I would argue that both are true to an extent. When you look at it very micro, for instance, the USAID grants that I worked on in Mombasa, those were very specific HIV prevention programs. And it was under what was called the AFIA 2 grant, and that was a network-based program. So I think there were 5 other organizations that were given the grant in the region, and we all worked with a very specific set. So there was a organization that dealt with young mothers. There was an organization that dealt with men. We worked with sex workers. So that included young girls as well as women. So everybody had their population, and then we all kind of came together and talked about what was working and did the same sort of approach via peer education. And in that respect, I would say, yeah, I was seeing it being effective. There was buy-in. We had, as I said, we had peer educators. We trained sex workers to go and they would give out condoms at the nightclubs that other sex workers were working in. You know, first they did someone prevent contraction of HIV because we gave them that condom. But it's the education. It's letting people know their options and about the programs that exist or about their health. So when you're educating individuals and seeing that impact and seeing that, yes, they're understanding what I'm saying, it's hard to argue that that's not effective in some way.
Interesting. Yeah, the education is sort of a favorite topic of mine, and I think the teaching to fish is really the education part of it, and that will certainly have longer term impacts. You mentioned the you know, giving condoms, having sex workers learn about the importance of condoms and giving it out. I know you had a similar experience here in the U.S., which is perhaps even a little bit more difficult here than it was there. But before we get on to that, we've got a couple callers with questions. So I'm going to invite people into talk with us. First caller is been waiting for a bit. I appreciate it. From area code 508, I believe, yes, area code 508. Welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Howard, calling from Cape Cod. I guess my question was, are these subjects of poverty reduction domestically or internationally seen as coffee party programs at this point?
That's a good question. I think what we try to do on the radio show a little bit is expand and relate to the core coffee party principles. And you know, Eric is probably in probably a little bit better position to ask that. But whenever we talk about the way money is being spent in this country, and in particular when we have something that's we think is a very, very hot topic, a very, very important topic, like Obamacare, it just sort of got us thinking about the impact on poverty. And so on the radio shows, we tend to be a little bit more we sort of, and myself in particular, I'll speak for myself, go off the reservation a little bit to talk about general social issues in a civil manner in ways that perhaps you can't hear about other ways. So perhaps you could argue that poverty is not a bullseye topic for the Coffee Party vision. On the other hand, there are probably not too many places that you can be on a radio show and talk about poverty without having two talking heads screaming at each other and using either invective and rhetoric. So occasionally we do sort of talk about some of these other topics. Was there a particular question you had for
again, one of my dissatisfactions has been, as I'm about to do my renewal or not in the Coffee Party, is that I've been finding it's been losing focus from the three original issues. And this seems to be just keeping going more broadly.
So I think the media, the idea of the 99% media for us is to give as much voice as possible, and it's related to the overall Coffee Party story, the overall Coffee Party mission of bringing the conversation back to people. And you will find where perhaps in the past 90-95% of Coffee Party conversations were about those three issues, the campaign finance reform and the tax code and Wall Street money and politics. Perhaps now it's 85% or 90% as we begin to diversify and invite people in.
Okay, me make the decision not to renew that.
I'm certainly sorry to hear that.
Work on those three issues and to be focused on them. So if it's becoming a general progressive social approach, it's just not for me. And I'm just looking for information on this.
Okay, fair enough. We certainly appreciate your listening either way. And we would ask that you give several of the shows a few more listens before you make that decision.
I have, and I'm seeing this as a pattern.
Okay.
This is just, I asked the question here because this was farthest from what I saw of the core values than anything else that I've heard, and I was wondering why it was being addressed.
Okay,
I'll just respond. I think I should take more responsibility than anybody. It's been my idea that, competing for the segment of the population, although it's a growing segment, that recognizes the issue of money in politics, tax code reform, and Wall Street reform at the heart of everything that is plaguing our country right now, it's not the direction that the Coffee Party is going to go. And I'm sorry to lose you, Howard. You've been a great contributor over the months and years. But we have limited resources, and we are using them to encourage people to participate rather than to try to force them to participate in the ways that we prescribe for them. And it's part because we really believe in allowing people to be who they are and to organize within the Coffee Party at the same time. But also, we feel that one of the reasons why money in politics is so powerful is that it can buy media products. And we feel that the best antidote to that is to create media products that are of, by, and for the 99%. In other words, the of, by, and for we the people. And I think Michael can attest, and all of our radio hosts can attest, is that if you have these radio shows that are open call and they allow for people to express their views and to talk about the issue of the day, but you can't actually go on the air unless the issue of the day fits within this narrow focus. It just limits the scope that your show can have. So, yeah, we are moving into more of a broader focus, and there are people who have been with us who will be disappointed, and there'll be people who'll be joining us and will be quite pleased. And people who are people of color, immigrants, people who are gays and lesbians, people interested in women's issues are pleased that we can talk about other things and be copyrighted at the same time. And then those who, especially those who are really focused on there'll be people who are unhappy, and that's just the way it goes.
And let's not forget also Eric, moderate Republicans, because I'm certainly not a progressive.
With moderate Republicans, it does kind of help us. I think it exposes that there are a lot more Americans who find themselves alienated by the extremism on the right that makes it possible for our ruling class to make all our laws for us. And it does have to do with social issues, and it does have to do with essentially harvesting hatred toward people of color and people who are in poverty. So I do think it, if we can break that monopoly that they have, that, or that break that propaganda stream that they have and infuse the conversation with the views of people who aren't consumers of 1% media products, who haven't bought into the notion that poverty is a race issue or that healthcare is a race issue, and have a different conversation, I think it, in the long run, it'll be better for our country. And that's what the Coffee Party is really here to do, is to shift the narrative in a way that's good for our country.
More, definitely more eloquently put than I have. Thank you, Eric. I'm going to... I want to shift the conversation back towards our main topic tonight and bring in Jessica English, who, as I mentioned earlier, is the host of The Bottom Line on Sundays, Sunday afternoons, 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific. I always want to make sure I get that right. I'll do a plug for my companions here. Jessica, how are you?
Thank you. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. What would you like to talk to Allison about?
Well, I just want to thank you for having this conversation, because I rarely hear about this topic in such an insightful manner, and I'm really enjoying finding out more about the statistics and the breakdown. And I was just wondering if we could talk a little bit about, and I guess the thing that really made me raise my hand was the conversation about what is poverty. And when you talked about, when you posed the idea of could we ever eliminate poverty, and though I do agree that there will always be demarcations between people's incomes, I do want to challenge the notion that we can't get rid of it. Poverty to me is partially in my mind are those experiences of living in eastern Tennessee and in mountains of Virginia, where, you know, I went to school with classmates that didn't have teeth and couldn't always be clean, but really, in my own life, poverty has meant having being insecure. So being food insecure, housing insecure, not knowing when you're going to get the money for the rent, not knowing where your next meal is going to come from, and not being able to take your kid to the doctor without ending up having collections hanging over your head, which forces you out of lines of credit that would lead to transportation security and that kind of thing. And so, though I do believe that there will always be people who have more and people who have less, I do think that with the fact that we do grow enough food in this world to provide food for everyone, that we could eradicate some of this insecurity that people who are in poverty and the very definition of poverty who are going through that. And so I'm just wondering, with her work in Africa and with her knowledge of America's budget towards giving to the rest of the world, you know, we're using so many of the world's resources in this country. What are some of the solutions she's seen maybe or can talk about where we are starting to work toward providing more security for those people who... some people might call it poverty. I would just say extreme insecurity.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, the insecurity. And I hadn't thought about it before, but under those definitions, I've been there myself. Allison, using that lens of you know, insecurity as a way of, you know, feeling poor or actually, you know, experiencing poverty. Either, you know, you can talk about either your experiences in Africa or perhaps, you know, closer to home, your experiences in D.C. and Jacksonville. How much do you see that? Is that an issue that people, you know, are they worried about? Do they see it as an insecurity issue, the way Jessica's described it?
Yeah, you know, I think that was a really great way to put it. And I think that, Jessica, you're absolutely right. The vision is that all of those, that everyone can have secure access to food, housing, healthcare, transportation, and I think I do share that vision. Though it is sometimes hard to say, yes, that we will have no homeless people. Every family will be, you know, secure in all of those ways. So it is the ideal, and I think that we are working towards it. In my own experience, I would say abroad, and this is just not really based on any numbers, just perception, I would say that we're offering better health services and health security abroad. When you look at HIV prevention, malaria prevention, basic health care, things like that, we're making an impact there.
So I'm sorry, I just have to interrupt. I think everybody should be aware of the irony alert at this point, that
right.
We can't seem to do that here.
Right. And also, it's different standards. It's not necessarily this. And to be honest, too, the cost of health care abroad compared to here is just to the same procedure you could have done, let's say, in Nairobi, Kenya, for a fraction of what it would cost to have it done here. So that could also be part of the case why we're able to address the issues abroad. It's not costing as much. And a lot of that, I believe, has to do with insurance companies and malpractice insurance rates that doctors have to cover and things like that. That doesn't exist in Kenya. And so you can, I know this is just one very concrete example. I had a friend, an American, who while she was living abroad had her IUD inserted in Kenya because it only cost about $50. And I know from my experience here, the device and the procedure cost about $3,000. So you have that drop off what it's actually cost to provide the services.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then going back to Jessica's question, though, and the way that she worded it and thinking about the context here in the U.S., most of my clients that I work with have access to government programs that at least strive to give them food security, housing security, health care. You know, I have a lot of clients on food stamps. I have a lot of clients who receive HUD housing, Medicaid and Medicare. I would say transportation is obviously more of a local issue. And that's one big issue that we have here in Jacksonville is that this city is not walkable. Our public transportation, it could take you 3 hours just to get from one side of town to other. So that's a big issue, and that becomes an economic hindrance as well because people can't really get themselves to work on time. I have a 15-year-old client, he just turned 15, who got a summer job, and I'm so proud of him and so happy. He did that through doing a job training program at my organization, but he has to leave his house at about 5:45 in the morning just to get to his job that starts at 8 o'clock because his grandmother can't provide transportation to him. And he's willing to do that because he's 15 and he's got the energy and can get there. But it becomes a hindrance when you have kids to get to school on time and get everything. You know, you can't leave the house before they go to school and et cetera. And so transportation security, I think, definitely also contributes to poverty here.
Interesting. So the you started talking about Jacksonville, and it's not a place that I would necessarily associate with either poverty or wealth, particularly. You know, it's just kind of a city in Florida, someplace that's not Orlando and doesn't have a theme park. But I understand you've had in some cases more obstacles working in your own city than you ever had working in Africa to get things done.
Absolutely. And part of that has to do with the extremist conservative agenda, right? I work on two teen pregnancy prevention programs here in Jacksonville. The first, that I work on is called the CSU1, and it actually started with the welfare reform program. What we were seeing is a lot of young women having babies in their teens, and then, of course, there's a cycle of teen pregnancies. Those young children themselves will become teen parents. And so my program was meant to be sort of what we call a wraparound approach to youth development and keeping those babies who were children of teen parents from becoming teen parents themselves. And then I also teach sex education across all of the programs that we offer.
So I imagine you're getting a lot of resistance around some of those narratives we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah. And we have the support of Dolores Weaver, who was the wife of Jacksonville Jaguars owner Wayne Weaver. And if you follow sports, the Jaguars were just sold to a new owner. And he's keeping the Jaguar Foundation mission the same, which is to help youth. It's all sorts of youth programs. But Dolores Weaver was a huge women's advocate, and she was the one who was really pushing the sex ed program and giving money for it. And since she's stepped out, especially, it's been difficult because we don't have that money backing us, that, oh, well, Dolores has our back. And here in Jacksonville, it is very conservative. The Southern Baptists kind of own the city. You have to go through pretty much through their politics to get anything passed. And we used to give out free condoms at our organization, and there was a city councilman who was part of the Southern Baptist Church who came in and was outraged and ended up threatening, some other funding. And so now we don't. And it's a disservice to our teens who, if you ask them what they need, that is what they need. They can't, if they have $12 to spend, they're not going to spend it on a box of condoms. They're going to spend it on food or, clothes or less money to get to their job or whatever it might be. So it just ends up creating more of a problem than solving it.
You know what the obvious response would be, right? Is don't have sex, right?
From a conservative perspective, absolutely. it's unrealistic. My perspective on teens having sex is that if they're ready, and especially if they're thoughtful enough to be coming up and saying, hey, Miss Allison, are you giving out free condoms yet? And continually saying, how can we get this started? What can we do, Miss Allison? We really want this. It shows a level of maturity that, and some of the kids that were asking to be a part of that initiative were not necessarily engaging in sexual activity yet. It's not realistic to tell teens no, especially when most adults were having sex when they were teenagers, regardless of their religion.
I actually agree with you. I was just, I think it is absolutely unrealistic, any absolutism or fundamentalist approach from any direction will, I think the one thing all those approaches will share is an absence of realism.
Right.
So, I'd never sort of heard it put that way. Actually, if you've got $12 to spend, what are you going to spend it on? If you're a teenager, you're going to spend it on food, but that doesn't mean you're not going to do other things. I think you're absolutely right. I want to ask you a question. We've got a couple callers in queue I'd like to bring in. Are you okay to stay an extra 10 or 15 minutes, Allison?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So just very quickly, I'm going to bring in a caller from area code 610 who's been quite patient. Just before I do, I want to give the phone number out again. This is The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network. And the call-in number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 646-929-2495. And remember just to press 1 and let us know you're interested in joining the conversation. And we ask for a little bit of patience as we move through the queue here. Right now, I'd like to bring in a caller from area code 610. 610, thank you for your patience. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Bob Trotner from Lehighville, Pennsylvania Coffee Party.
Hi. Did you say Bob? I have a little bit of a weak connection here. Bob.
Yeah, I have a bad connection, too. I just have two real quick comments and then a question that I'm interested in. First of all, I think this was a great show, and I really enjoyed this show, and that's the one thing I want to say. Second,
well, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
No, really. Second thing is to just say something to the caller who called a couple calls ago regarding not liking the show. This is not Coffee Party position. This is my position. I consider myself a moderate or slightly left of center. But as far as after three core issues, I just have a great need to be educated about certain issues, about any issues, really. And I consider these shows educational. I don't necessarily agree with everything that's talked about, but I think that's part of, I think just looking at it as an educational situation, having a great opportunity to learn about something is more than saying whether I disagree or disagree. It's just Like, tell me about it, and then I'll make a decision. So that's
well,
what I wanted to say about.
Thank you very much for that as well. That's
a
good thing. And by the way, if you agreed with everything, I don't think we'd be doing our job very well. So, particularly on this show.
now, the reason why I called is I find it very interesting because I have what I call, he's not really my stepson, but an adopted son, but I call him my adopted son. He's in a refugee camp in Ghana, and we talk on Facebook quite a bit. I learn about his life, and it's just incredible. But he's in a refugee camp in Ghana. He's been there since he was about, I guess, about 8 or 9 years old. He was. His parents were killed, and he came to the refugee camp when he was about 8 years old during the revolution or the civil war in Liberia in the 90s. So he just there was which I hardly even knew about that but so this is very interesting to me. I'm getting a perspective. He has some idea of, you know, he hears once in a while about corruption and all that stuff. He has some conception of it, that rich people are getting the stuff and they're treating everybody in the refugee camp very badly. There's like one doctor for everybody, and you have to pay for everything. The president of Ghana just got a Nobel Peace Prize a year or two ago, and yet she seems to be one of the people who are in cahoots with the big corporations and the bribery. And this is my perception. She supports big international corporations coming in and rich people in Ghana making a lot of money, and the people in the refugee camps and the other poor people just being ignored. In fact, I guess they tried to have some kind of rebellion there or something, and they came in with the shotguns and they killed people. So I don't know if she knows anything about that, but the corruption and the way people are treating refugee camps and stuff like that, I don't know if she can comment on that, but.
Sure. I can address it in the context that I'm familiar with. So I don't know a whole lot about refugee camps in Ghana, but I will talk about the situation in Kenya, if that's okay.
And by the way, he's 24 years old. He's been there from the time he was about 8 years old, and now he's 24. He's trying to make a life for himself. Very difficult. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, that I was actually going to ask that. In Kenya in 2007, they had what we've just notoriously called the post-election violence. There was an uproar that the election was rigged, and so certain tribes just went. There was violence. There was people tipping over buses, fires, killings, and that was the first really incident of that kind in Kenya. Mostly, you know, tribes got along, and when they say tribe in Kenya, it's mostly just kind of like how in New Jersey it's like, oh, I'm Italian, you're Irish, you know. It's not necessarily a huge divide. They sometimes think of it as their race, even though we see race as color. But after the post-election violence in Kenya, there were refugee camps put up because some of the slums were just scorched. And when I was back there, even into 2009, these refugee camps were still just tent cities. All the displaced people, nothing had been done to rebuild their homes, despite the fact that there was supposed to have been money spent. So I think housing refugees is certainly a problem all across the world, right? Because who actually is paying for the refugee camps? Is it the country that's housing them? Are they saying, yes, you can come live on our soil and we'll support you? However, most of the time, these countries are developing countries themselves. So it ends up being outside NGOs who are providing the money. You know, for someone to have been in a refugee camp for their lives, it's certainly alarming, right? How are they being educated? How are they being taught to get out of that situation. And again, that kind of relates back to poverty in America when we think of American inner city or urban populations or rural populations, how are young children being educated to get themselves out of that situation and into a better environment? I think that that is really just the root of poverty in itself. What are the resources that are provided? You know, I can't speak specifically to your situation, but I think, as Michael has said, education is key. If we're providing education to the people who are in disadvantaged situations, theoretically, that's an outlet for them to be able to better their situation.
Is there a sense that money that's, I think you were talking about this briefly, but is there a sense that money that's supposed to be allocated or those kinds of things, the refugee camp, are being put into the pockets of people who are supposed to be providing the services because of the corruption and they're not reaching?
Yeah.
I have the impression, I think that's what you were saying, and that seems to be what's happening in Ghana. Are you also saying that's happening in Kenya, that the money is just being pocketed and not going where it's supposed to be going, and everybody knows that?
Corruption is obviously a huge issue across the developing world, and especially when we think about foreign aid, because it's money being given for a certain cause, and we don't expect it to go towards a particular person. You're absolutely right. It's corruption is wrong on any level. I will bring that back to the idea of developing countries and Africa in particular just having bad PR. The corruption is really just more blatant. Corruption happens here every day, but it's a little bit more underhand or under the table, and it happens in deals where we don't see it so blatantly in how we view abroad.
Right. Okay.
So thank you very much for calling, Bob. I appreciate it. What the corruption issue is interesting to me because, I mean, there's a few levels, right, on sort of a, you know, coffee party sweet spot we'll be talking about. And by the way, I apologize. We shouldn't do a show, you know, on the night before the 4th of July when I have dogs who don't like fireworks. so I apologize to all the listeners. On the one hand, you know, money is being spent in order to influence the kinds of people who would be elected, who would theoretically stop you from doing what you do. That's one level of corruption. There's also a level, you know, other kinds of levels of corruption where the things that you're trying to do simply don't get to you in time. What kinds of things have you experienced here in the States as far as corruption?
I would say, you know, luckily, on the nonprofit end here in the U.S., I haven't really seen any sort of corruption really in any context that I can think of. The executive directors or most levels of people that I've worked with here are just very want to carry out their mission. You know, I think that if anything, I've seen budgets mismanaged in a way that, oh, well, we don't have the money for, you know, we got this grant for this particular thing, but maybe let's just take a couple of dollars and spend it on this other program, which isn't necessarily how it's supposed to work. And I think funders would be upset if they found that out. But at the end of the day, it's not nearly as bad as say, just as a CEO of a foreign company just taking money off the top.
Well, yeah, sure. Again, different levels. What about from the other side? Have you do you feel the political pressure in the organizations that you work with, feeling like funding might be cut if you don't do things a certain way, or having to battle for every dollar against you know, moneyed interests?
Yeah, absolutely. Here in the U.S., funding is so competitive for nonprofit organizations. The organization that I work with right now actually was fairly lucky and didn't really get hit by the recession. Their funding remained fairly steady. But in terms of, I know people who work in development, meaning their main job is bringing in money for an organization, I do not envy them. There's a bigger push for smaller donations, lots of individual donations, rather than the bigger foundation grants, or I guess in addition to, as supplement. And I think tying it back into the fact that, that poverty and the way we address issues are very similar here and here and abroad is evaluations of these programs. I've found the nonprofit sector here to not take evaluation as seriously as it should. Either it gets pushed to the last minute because everyone's so overworked and trying to get the projects done, and then you just kind of half-ass an evaluation program. But mostly I see that evaluation is just to be able to say to your funder, look, we did what you wanted to say. We report numbers to say, okay, we hit the numbers that you wanted to hit without really focusing on what do those numbers mean, or saying, hey, we failed at this, and saying, okay, why did we fail and let's change, because people are so afraid that they're going to lose their funding for whatever program they're working on.
Well, that's interesting. In that sense, it's not very different from the corporate quarterly report of sort of having to focus on the kinds of statistics or the kinds of quote unquote successes that will, you know, make sure that the higher ups keep the money flowing. Interesting.
Right.
We have one more caller. Eric, did you want to chime in here? We have a caller coming in on Skype. I was going to bring into the call.
Sure. Let's go to the Skype caller.
Okay. So we have. I always love it. It's area code 111, which tells us it's a Skype caller. Where are you calling? What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, sir. This is Marty. I'm calling from Buffalo, New York.
Welcome to the show, Marty. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I appreciate you providing the ability for me to share my opinions and ideas.
Please do.
What's going on here, sir, is very, very, very serious in America right now. I just wanted to explain very quickly that below the chat blog is a few links. It also goes into a little bit greater detail because I don't want to take and tie up your time here on your radio show. But what I need to explain is the idea that, well, let me start by saying it's where all the fighting is coming from in America right now. When the federal government takes and confiscates individual money and puts that money in a pile, you've got every individual interest out there trying to get at that money.
No question.
This is where the fighting's coming from. When I'm a company that's allowed to move to China and could come back to my congressman or senator and ask you for a grant, and you're able to give me that money while I'm in China, that's wrong. Because, A, that's not your money to be given away to begin with. That's the taxpayer money. And, B, I'm taking and I'm giving you a kickback for your election campaign. And meanwhile, it's the taxpayers getting fleeced. All right. I wanted to go into a little bit of detail, if I had time, of why jobs and poverty exists in this country right now, and it's in part due to the Federal Reserve and their confiscation of money. In America, I've got employment-related taxes that I have to spend, Social Security, workman's comp, unemployment, EPA regulations, OSHA violations, all kinds of regulation. If I go to China, I don't have any of that. In China, the Chinese government will give me free electricity, they'll give me free heat for my workers, and I'm still able to apply for those grants and stuff like that and get the perks out of the American government as well. So I'm getting the best of both worlds in corporate welfare from both countries. When you hear the Republicans saying that they're going to cut taxes, well, let me tell you something. In 2004, under the Bush tax cuts, I was able to write off my cost of moving from here in America over to China. You remember the gas price spikes? Those were caused by our jobs swimming over to Beijing because there was limited supply of gasoline here in America. The American people are getting screwed so bad right now that they don't even realize it. And
now listen, finish your point there.
And I don't mean to come off as anti-Republican, because the Democrats are equally to blame. It was Bill Clinton that passed the NAFTA Act. So where I'm coming from is that now that I'm in China, I could take and send my products here tax and duty free. This is both parties doing this. When I'm here in America, if I want to sell a product to China, it's 7 times the amount and value of the product I'm selling here in America. What I could give you for $5 will cost you $35 if you were a citizen in China and I was selling it to you. who in the hell is going to create a job here in America?
Okay. Thank you, Marty, for your call. Allison, I wanted to ask you to respond. I think in a nutshell, the what Marty was able to add to the conversation is that when we do have a system where we pool our money in order to accomplish things that we couldn't accomplish individually, there are going to be interests that lobby for that money. And Howard Berkowitz called earlier to say that we focus on money in politics. And maybe you could help us out, Allison, and connect it, because I think it probably is true that at the very base of the political process is this question: are we pulling this money for the sake of people, or are we pulling this money for the sake of profiteers?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and it actually brings me back to a point of focus that I have not yet gotten across, is sort of reforming the way that we give money, especially abroad. And we see this on smaller scales, and it's starting to happen on larger scales, but rather than just throwing money at programs, doing micro-lending or business lending, so that it's not just we're giving you the money, it's we're making an investment. The Guermin Foundation does this in micro-lending. There's a great organization called the Global Business Fund that does medium-sized business lending, so it's not just the $50 to a taxi driver in, Paraguay. It's, $50,000 or more for a business loan to get development projects started. And they're seeing huge success in that realm and having the buy-in from the money that they're lending. People are working harder to have to pay it back rather than just knowing it's a grant that they can apply to be renewed. And I don't know enough, but I've thought in, can we do micro-lending here in America with low-income people? And I know that there are some people who are starting to try it rather than just doing grants, doing micro-lending for low-income people.
Allison, you said you're in Jacksonville, is that right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're basically, you've got your head down, you're working hard to try to improve people's lives, and you're competing for funding. And you said that it was the most powerful church or the system of churches, the Baptist church, that opposes funding that helps people who are in poverty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my question is, do you ever put your head up and just sort of like put your finger in the political winds and you ask yourself, why would a church, a Christian church, take the position that when we pool our money, it's not to help people, but rather to help profiteers? What would get them to essentially align themselves with political interests that, as Marty pointed out, are very happy to have corporate welfare to subsidize profits? For instance, Jessica English, who was on earlier, maybe she'd like to come back again just before we go. Jessica English works for Target. Target does not pay a living wage because they want to increase their profits. So the taxpayers pool their money so that people who work for Target can have enough to eat. Target doesn't allow people to work enough hours to have health care. So we, the people, pool our money so that we essentially can subsidize Target's profits. And it just, that was one thing that jumped out at me earlier. Your biggest opposition, or basically the mafia boss that you have to go to, so that the people can pool their money to help people instead of profiteers in Jacksonville, Florida, is a Christian church who's on the side of the profiteers. I mean, do you ever put your head up and say, man, well, I'm working so hard here, but why are there so many forces working against me?
With the specific example of the Baptist church, it's mostly just that they're just pushing their social agenda. But you're absolutely right. The idea that there are people profiting in this country while other people are suffering, or taxpayers are subsidizing other people, if I had a solution to that, I probably would not be on this internet radio show. I'd be writing books and winning the Nobel Peace Prize. it does get frustrating, absolutely. I think that the only thing that keeps people going who work on these issues is that there is hope, and that there are really great projects that people are working on, and there is money coming in from the government. There is money coming in from private donors and from corporations as well. And at the end of the day, there is the common goal of helping people, whether it's, you know, poverty eradication or whatever issue that, that people in the nonprofit world or the public sector are taking to heart. They're trying to make things better for someone somewhere.
I also think, and maybe Allison, you can speak to this because I'm sure both exist in any organization you've been in. There are people, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you fit into this first category, that sort of, you know, put their heads down and work with one child at a time or one poor person at a time or one adult struggling to find a place to live at a time. And then there are people that involve themselves in essentially the same mission but on more of a macro level, and they're the ones who are fighting the political battles or speaking before Congress or running for office even in order to get their agendas across. Do you find that the where is that mix in the organizations that you've worked for? Do they always have both, and does it work effectively?
That's a tough question. I recently started my master's of public administration at the University of Southern California, which theoretically will give me skills to work more on that macro level, right? Take me out of working directly with populations or directly with youth and addressing larger issues or doing more management and program development. And that's a hard sell for me at some points because in my view, it's hard to imagine not working directly with kids or directly with families because that's how you see where you're making a difference. You're working with one child and seeing an improvement or, you know, getting a thank you card from a grandmother who you helped through a tough time. I would say organizations that are successful have to do both. Not necessarily every person at that organization is doing everything, but you have to have somebody who's lobbying for your cause, who's talking to city council, who's getting funding into your project, who's marketing what you're doing, and being that big picture person, and then have it trickle down to people who are working directly in the field. You know, on a large scale, organizations like Planned Parenthood do that very well. They provide direct services locally. They have, you know, small health clinics all over the United States, but then they also have their political leg. Every region has their advocacy branch, and then they have their national advocacy. So they're doing very micro and macro to try and to push their agenda and help people at the same time.
Well, I'm going to see if Jessica English wants to come back on. I gave her a little bit of a warning because I think Howard has put forth a really interesting question for us to ponder, is what is the link between poverty and money? Well, that's obvious, but the link between poverty and money and politics, because you mentioned Planned Parenthood. And once again, what we have is a strange allegiance between people who are very, 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 very wealthy, a few families and multinational corporations who bankroll these narratives that turn us, even Christian people, against poor people, against people who are ethnic, against immigrants, which is really not really part of what I understand the Bible to talk about in terms of welcoming the stranger. And so the question, you know, really is for us all, you know, if we can insert an alternative narrative that is more in the interest of the people, as they did in Egypt, for instance, using social media as well, they inserted a second narrative in between the 1% and the people, and the people chose a narrative that was in their interest. So I'm just wondering, and maybe Jessica, you could comment on this as well, being the person who actually, you know, whose wages are subsidized by the taxpayers so that you can be a good worker and so that Target can pad their profits and not pay you enough to survive or feed your family and survive. You know, maybe there is a role for those of us who understand how money and politics and poverty are all related in this simple equation. Do we pool our money as Americans in order to improve the quality of life for human beings, for our fellow Americans, for the people in this country? Is that the definition of patriotism, love of the people in this country? Or do we pool our money in order for it to be extracted by those who have the wealth and the political power to write the tax code and the regulations in their favor? In other words, is it people or profit?
Well, I just want to tell Allison not to sell herself short. I think she may not be winning a Nobel Peace Prize or profiting on a book, but she is the solution, right? She's purposing herself and her life to help people who are working their butts off and still struggling to survive. And not only is she doing that with them one-on-one, but then she's helping the rest of us understand that issue and the reasons and the solutions behind that. So I think that's amazing. And I'm also not going to sell the poor short. I mean, we're still going to be here. We're still going to be working because just to throw out some numbers for you, you know, we have not increased the monthly stipend to families who are on welfare since 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a family of four still only qualifies for about $400 a month or $600 a month, and that's not going to pay rent anywhere. So even if you're on welfare, you're going to be working, right? Because there's no way that you can survive on that monthly stipend. And that's why we created the housing program. But there are millions and millions of people standing in invisible lines all over this country waiting for a program that has a year-long waiting list. And so in the meantime, you're going to be staying in a shelter. You're going to be going to work odd hours whenever you can dump your kids on somebody because you can't get on the daycare program. And so I'm not going to sell the poor short because they're going to continue working just as I have, and I've seen my coworkers and other people I know in my similar situation doing. And I'm not going to sell the profiteers short. I think that we are starting to see, because of this 99% media, people standing up and telling the truth. Just like I did down in Washington, D.C., just like a lot of people have done all over this country with Occupy and with the Coffee Party platform where we were able to get together and talk about these things. I'm sure at coffee parties that are held all over the country when people gather together in groups like I'll get to do on Saturday. I think we are telling our stories and we are sharing our struggles. And I know that there are people of faith in communities all over this nation and world who are helping people because they have people knocking on their doors asking for help. So I do think that we need to pool resources as long as there is not a living wage. And what I was talking about before about being insecure, no matter how much I work, I'm going to be food insecure. I'm going to be housing insecure. I'm going to be health care insecure. And that's what my welfare person calls it, the person that my worker, that's what she calls it. She asks me, are you food insecure? That's their terminology. And there are millions of people like me, and we are insecure like this for years and years and years, sometimes lifetimes, as long as there is a minimum wage that is a poverty wage. As long as companies are given the go-ahead and even given, you know, freedoms and bonuses and you know, kickbacks to be allowed to do that. But I'm not going to give up on those people. I think they're going to wake up and see what's going on and what those policies do. And I think the American people, especially when one out of every two are poor and low income, are going to start realizing that what the real problem is here is it's not that people aren't working hard enough, and it's not that people aren't generous enough. It's just that we haven't been able to expose the truth and the solutions that we can grow out of that truth. So I just hope that people continue talking about it, and I just want to thank Allison for talking about that.
Allison, would you like to
put it?
Go ahead, Allison.
I just want to say that I like the way that you tied it together. I think that you were able to talk about the things that I talked about, and again, and the Coffee Party agenda in a way that I am not able to articulate. That was just a very good way to wrap it up.
Thanks. What I'd like to do, and we've got just 3 or 4 minutes left, is I kind of want to circle back to this idea of narrative and to kind of wrap up by having each of us talk about what we think, are there narratives that we're caught in that we really should, you know, consciously try to break out of related to poverty, and maybe we can sort of go out on that message of, you know, remember poverty is not what you've been told it is in this way, but it really is something we should think about this way. And Jessica, I'm going to include you in this. You obviously have participated quite a bit and have a lot of personal experience. And I will reserve the right as co-host to take the last word. No, actually, I'll give you the last word. Eric, Allison, why don't you start? What is sort of the narrative we should beware of and the narrative you think we should pay attention to?
Sure. I will say, and I don't want to steal what you said, but thinking about poverty in different ways, and like I've said, comparing poverty abroad to poverty here, and what's glamorous, and what are we really seeing, and thinking that poverty is not just an African-American problem or an urban problem, and really seeing it in the big picture. One thing when I talk about HIV is that I always kind of preface it that it's not an African problem, it's not an African-American problem, it's not a gay problem. It's affecting every single American, particularly in certain urban areas. Nobody is not at risk. And particularly in this economic climate, we need to think of poverty in the same way. It's not just one group's problem. It's everybody's problem. Whether or not you're at risk of suffering from poverty, you can do something to help or understand it better.
Jessica English, would you like to close? Give your closing comment?
Sure. I think that poverty, the thing to beware of with poverty is to really think that it's something. Just one moment, I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll just really quickly say that I think that the...
Sorry about that.
No worries. I think there's a very powerful force in our religious teachings of the many religions, especially the ones that are dominant in America. And, of course, those are the Protestant, evangelical, Christian religions. I think that those of us who are raised in the church are perhaps more inviting to dogmatic ideologies, and those can that tendency to believe there's an absolute truth, and to believe that there's a moral struggle and that we should expand our morals to try to affect other people's lives, it can be exploited. And I think for the period of time when our national narrative was dominated by the 1%, by those people who could afford to purchase the news networks and the radio networks with which to complain that their side isn't being heard, and to convince us that the opposite is true about those networks. But they use all of those microphones, all of those airwaves to tell narratives about the poor that either focus on race in order to create division so we can't love our brothers and sisters the way the Bible teaches us, or they focus on our sexual organs, and they try to say that it is our job to essentially legislate how people use their genitals. And I don't think that's what God intended us to think about or to do when we work collectively to improve each other's lives. And whether teenagers have sex or not shouldn't really be a factor when we ask ourselves if we want to help the poor. Okay, Jessica, let's see if you can come back in and for your last word, and then we'll go.
Sure, sorry.
We've got about 1 minute.
Okay, I just want to say poverty is not an indictment from God. And I think that we have to really beware of anybody who says so, anybody who says that the people in Haiti experienced that horrific, earthquake and then the resulting horrors of it. It's not an indictment from God. Poverty is a choice that we all make.
Vera, I love that phrase. Poverty is not an indictment of God. I may steal it, or you're going to have to blog about it very quickly, or before I steal
it. Do it.
So I would just like to add the narrative that from where I sit that gets bought into a lot is that somehow that poverty is partisan, and there part of the mythology is that Republicanism by definition, the entire spectrum of Republicanism, is against the poor, when in fact, the GOP was founded on these kinds of human issues back in 1860. So there is a fundamentalist wing that is absolutely about the money and about the corporations, But that's another narrative we need to be wary of. So we're just about out of time. I want to thank everybody for participating. Allison, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. And hopefully we'll have a chance to have you back in the future. And, of course, all our callers, I appreciate your coming in. And thanks very much, and we'll talk to you all next week.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the middle ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by the consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on the Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.